Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. The coronavirus pandemic continues to surge in the United States with fatalities above 150,000 and another 1.4 million new unemployment claims, bringing the total out of work to well north of 30 million. And the second quarter containing the sharpest drop in U.S. economic history. Where are we on the fourth stimulus package, the National Defense Authorization Act appropriations, as well as the administration's proposal to cut 12,000 U.S. troops from Germany? Joining us to discuss an action-packed week in Washington are Dr. Gordon Adams of the Quincy Institute Think Tank, Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm Capital Alpha Partners, Heather Connolly of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Mackenzie Eaglin of the American Enterprise Institute, and Iron Mike Herson of American Defense International, one of Washington's top defense lobbying firms. Everybody, welcome back to the program. And Heather, thanks very much for joining us for this podcast.
Great to be here.
Yes, thank you for having us back.
Welcome, everybody. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri, Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. And of course, Bell sponsors this podcast. Michael, let's start with you. As we have each week, the GOP has announced its version of the fourth stimulus package. Then it also includes billions of dollars more in defense, $1.75 billion to make sure that the former FBI building doesn't become a hotel that competes against President Trump's property across the street. It cuts jobless benefits. Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders issued a powerful tweet on Thursday listing billions of dollars for new weapons included in the GOP measure, ending with $0 for millions facing eviction, which was a pretty powerful tweet. Walk us through in any order that you want to, right? Maybe let's start just with the quick NDAA and appropriations, which is easy, and then let's get into the stimulus package. So give us kind of a quick on where we are on conference on that and where appropriators are this week.
Sure, that makes sense. And we'll start in with the good and go in descending order into what's bad. So the good is, as we discussed previously, NDAA has passed both chambers with veto-proof majorities and we'll be entering conference in August. I've talked to Democrat and Republican leaders on the committee, and there is a slight sense of optimism that they really could conference this bill and get it to the floor in September in preparation for the fiscal year. I still think that's probably unlikely given the president's veto threat that close to the election, but there is a good sense of optimism, so that's very positive on NDAA. On appropriations, defense appropriations is on the floor right now as we speak. As you know, last week they passed four appropriations bills. This week they plan to pass seven as a group, but they had to take the Homeland Security bill out. The progressives on the Democratic side complained that they did not want any bills that they were opposed to lumped in with the must-pass bills. Right. So Homeland now is in deep trouble because obviously Homeland is now at the center of the protests around the country because of the police forces that they're using are funded under Homeland. And the Republicans in the House don't like the Homeland bill because there's no wall money in that bill. So Homeland appropriations is now in serious jeopardy. But today and tomorrow, they should pass the defense bill, the Commerce, Justice, Science bill, energy and water, financial services, labor, HHS, and transportation. They have cobbled together the amendments into just 10 packages, so this will move relatively quickly and get passed. So that's the good news. Senate continues to be nowhere on appropriations, so that's the bad news on appropriations, but hopefully that process will come together after the election. Now, let's get on to the big news, which is the next relief package. So after a long wait, the Republicans have finally released their relief package, which is about $1 trillion price tag, much less than the Democrats' $3 trillion plus bill that was passed several weeks ago. Some of the highlights are, it's another round of $1,200 direct payments to individuals, more money for the Paycheck Protection Program, but a reduction in the unemployment benefits, the enhanced benefits, from $600 to $200 per week, and then some kind of formula after that, liability protections for businesses, and then some new money for testing and vaccines. But the big problem is that the Republicans are divided over this proposal in a big way, and publicly so. There have been one senator came out and said that it would be quite an accomplishment if McConnell's able to get half the conference. Another senator said, we have unity in disagreement. Others have called it a mess. Apparently, Senator Rand Paul stormed out of the daily lunch that the senators have because he was so upset about the price tag of $1 trillion. And at the same time, you know, Pelosi is saying publicly, it seems to her that McConnell isn't serious about wanting an agreement. She labeled this proposal as riddled with condescension and disrespect. No concern for the millions of children who are food insecure and people who can't pay their rent. And then, you know, at the same time, you know, Mnuchin and Meadows are up on the Hill, and Meadows says, hey, you know, we're just in the second inning here. And Mnuchin says this is just the beginning. Problem is that these extended unemployment benefits expire tomorrow,
right,
as well as the eviction protections expire. So, I mean, there's some big differences between the bills. I mean, Democrats want to extend the $600 weekly jobless payments while the Republicans don't. Republicans want liability shields for businesses, but the Democrats are focused on protection for workers. Democrats want $1 trillion for state and local governments, and Republicans offered zero for that. So that's a big sticking point. And the Republicans want to condition the school funding on reopening, which also is a huge sticking point. So,
right,
you know, McConnell's saying he's going to hold firm on the liability protections, you know, for schools and businesses. Same time, the Democrats are saying they're going to hold firm on the $600 enhanced unemployment benefits and the nearly $1 trillion for state and local aid. So they're very far apart. So there has been an idea floated to do what they call a skinny bill, try and do just extend the enhanced unemployment benefits and the eviction protections in the short run, kind of like you look at a CR to,
right,
give them time. However, that has been rejected. So that is not going to happen. And as you know, Pelosi is not in town right now to negotiate this. She is at the funeral for John Lewis. So the clock is running out.
Let's go to the defense elements of this. Obviously, there are multiple wheels that are spinning simultaneously. The Pentagon wants legitimate coronavirus charges covered that are incurred by contractors that are trying to execute their contracts. On the other hand, the GOP has put everything from F-35s, $2 billion for F-35. I mean, there's a lot of money for weapons programs in there. And there's a concern that some people have that the entire defense enterprise will sound tone deaf at a time when the nation is reeling from this and sort of asking for more money after it already got $740 billion, right? I mean, and I think Chairman Smith has been trying to sort of transmit that message to the Pentagon, right? Like, hey guys, try to take stuff out of hide because this is a tough time. Where do we stand on all the defense elements of the package?
Sure. So I'll say when you made a good point when you talk about tone deaf, there's one thing I neglected to mention is there is funding. One of the big differences between the two bills is that the Republicans want funding for a new FBI headquarters, which of course is catty corner to Trump's hotel. Many Republican senators are saying that they do not support that and don't expect it in the final package. However, Mark Meadows continues to be on the Hill saying this is a pressing need. And that really kind of dovetails with some of the defense stuff because there are some, you know, obviously legitimate needs, and Ellen Lord has been working very hard, and so has Esper, to get the funding for Section 3610 of the CARES Act, which, you know, was authorized, but really no money behind it to support these payments to contractors. That is in here, as well as the money for DPA, PPE, progress payments. But what was unexpected on top of that is this extra money for procurement, you know, over $8 billion. This is something that the White House wanted. It's something that actually Senate Republicans wanted in some of the earlier stimulus packages, but everybody was cool to it. I think that in the end, no one I've talked to thinks that those procurement items are going to be in the final package, that it's something that can probably be traded away. But I wouldn't think that it'd be traded away all the way down to just the money for to fund 3610, because there are some other legitimate requests in here for the Defense Production Act and other things that would support PPE, et cetera. But the requests for O&M are going to be tough ones because, as we've talked on previous podcasts, there is a lot of O&M money that has been unspent from this year because of the reduction in training and fuel costs and things like that. So, and there have been Democrats that I've talked to recently that look at me and say, hey, if the president can find $15 billion for the wall, he can find $10 billion to fund Section 3610. So this is far from a done deal.
And I can also understand how Democrats are responding rather viscerally to the notion that, you know, the GOP wants to top up the Pentagon accounts that were depleted because of the president's order to redirect military construction funding to the border wall. Mackenzie, let me bring you in. What's your sense on where we are, and kind of go around the horn? Gordon, I want to hear from you. Byron and Heather also, if you want to pitch in on this, on sort of where we stand and how you guys see this dynamic situation, both whether on the authorization side, but certainly on the stimulus side, and then the broader debate and how the DOD is perceived in the middle of this shooting match.
The popular perception is quickly congealing around this being a classic case of pork for primes. And it's absolutely not true. And I have no friends in the White House. So let me walk it through quickly, even though I know we talked about it a couple months ago. The way that the Defense Department primarily is injecting liquidity into its industrial base is through the awarding of contracts.
Right.
You need money via contracts and to keep employees continuing to come to work or have a job to come back to when they do. It's an essential workforce as designated by DHS. They have to go to work if they can under pretty much most circumstances, including through a pandemic. A lot of these, the particular emphasis, of course, has been on, you know, the third and fourth tier suppliers and vendors, unique suppliers where there's only one company of this type making this part for this munition, for example. A lot of these, you know, there's so much research that finds these companies, you know, they have small lines of credit. They don't have the margins to stay afloat on their own, absent contracts. What are contracts? Awards for things like weapons systems. And anybody who's been tracking this really closely knows that this has been the primary vehicle by which the service acquisition executives, like Hondo Gertz, have been using to keep these companies in business. The Pentagon put out a report last year on its industrial base saying, you know, there's a lot of companies that are at risk, not only of going out of business forever or of China acquiring them. And we've already seen through this pandemic, we have so many weaknesses in our supply chains to one country, China, who's the first named, you know, competitor in the defense strategy. So there really is a lot of good reasons behind this. But the headlines took off, and now it's as if nobody will stop and listen for more than a second about why this actually is legitimately related to a pandemic. The military needs these things anyway. They're going to get bought and paid for anyway. So yes, it's okay to include it. I just think that, you know, the Pentagon leadership is not doing a good job of explaining this. And by that, I don't mean Ellen Ward. I mean above her, you know, and I know that Mark Esper is only one man and he can only do so much, but it's incumbent upon him to explain, you know, that no, this isn't because, you know, Lockheed Martin CEO stood in the Rose Garden or whoever. This is really actually legitimately important. And this is the primary vehicle by which we keep companies that we absolutely need in business.
And we're going to talk about this a little bit, right? Dr. Esper kind of has his hands full with kind of a White House dynamic as well, obviously, with the announcement yesterday. Let me change the order up a little bit because you were talking about industrial base. Byron, why don't you start us off on what some of the dynamic factors here are? You've put together some extraordinary notes over the past week looking at this issue. Talk to us a little bit about how you see the dynamic and what the implications are, and what investors on the street are telling you as they look at the space, especially as the market tanked today with news that everything from the deepest drop in a quarter ever in U.S. economic history, all the way to the president saying that he wanted to potentially postpone the election, which wasn't received well either.
Well, a couple of things. I think obviously this is earnings season, and you know, you're really not seeing any material weakness. There was one exception with General Dynamics, but that was more related to an IT operation in Europe. But, you know, the cash flows have been quite strong. Northrop Grumman reported, you know, raised guidance, Lockheed raised guidance. So it's hard to say that, you know, there's any duress, certainly at the prime level. And they have all called out that they've been pushing down the advances in progress payments that were made by the Department of Defense down to their suppliers. I'd agree with Mackenzie. You know, I think this is really more kind of third, fourth tier issues, and you kind of have to overlay this with the announcements that came out of Boeing on their production cuts on their civil airliners and, you know, the kind of gloom from some of the airlines as well. I do think, however, that that $8 billion smells very porky, just given some of the programs that it funds. I could understand if this was $8 billion in procurement that was really more targeted at trying to shore up parts of the industrial base that may have been impacted by the sharp fall off in the commercial airliner sector. And but that's really not at all apparent. You know, when you see money being thrown at expeditionary medical ships, you know, the THAAD program, TPY-2 radar, you know, the F-35, the A-10 wing replacement. I mean, you know, all these things are programs that really have very little relation to the commercial aerospace industry, which I think if DoD was really interested in shoring up a part of the sector that it has to draw off going forward, that would be where they'd want to put that money. The P-8, maybe you could make that argument, but I think that would probably fall more squarely on KC-46A if that's where you're going to put incremental money and you wanted to help Boeing here. But those are my thoughts on that.
Exactly right. I mean, you would try to look at strategic impact in terms of, you know, you would almost want the DoD to be a little more French in how they would go about it. Gordon, you've been very patiently waiting. Give us your sense from the standpoint who's also sat inside on some of these deliberations and had to look at, you know, how they're perceived.
I'm sitting here. I was chewing on my nails while my good friend and colleague Mackenzie Eaglin was talking. This is so porky; it's not even to be believed. Frankly, the argument that this is all about speeding stuff to third and fourth tier contractors is irrelevant if what you're looking at is working those lines now, because contracts are one thing, cash flow, as Byron said, is another. And what we're really talking about here in terms of third and fourth tier is cash flow. And the cash flow argument, the argument is you got to do this pumping of the priming of the pump here because of cash flow, simply sets aside and ignores the reality that all these programs are under contract. Ignores the fact that prime contractors have large cash balances, as Byron knows. Knows that you have plenty of wiggle room here to manage an issue. I think it's a red herring to say that this is a third and fourth tier subcontractor issue. This is about getting wish lists previously desired into the mix while there's an opportunity to do so. And if you look at it, I think Byron's quite correct. You're not looking at a bunch of Boeing programs where you might have a real issue at the prime level. You know, you're looking at C-130Js and, you know, billions for F-35 and A-10 wing replacements and Stryker upgrades and Apache Bucks and Sana Boys, for goodness sakes. You know, this is opportunism masquerading as COVID. I can't imagine that the Hill is going to go for it, is going to say, yeah, what the hell, you know, well, as Senator Sanders said this morning, well, we're doing nothing for people who are losing unemployment benefits and their housing, and we're doing $20 billion worth of pork for systems in the Department of Defense, I repeat, that are already under contract, that are already have items that have been appropriated and budgeted and are being spent, when the money is not going to come out in any case in this process with a speed that would have very much to do with cash flow at all. I find it ludicrous and unbelievable to call it anything other than a pork reach. And I'm not saying there aren't things in here that may be legitimate reimbursements for actual expenditures or PPP stuff. It all may be there. I guarantee you it is not $30 billion. It is not $20 billion. It is not $10 billion. And the department, you know, I used to work in this business. The department has a lot of room, running room, and flexibility, as demonstrated by the ability to find wall money when they had to find wall money to be able to deal with those requirements in the Department of Defense. It smacks of a money grab. It smacks of implausibility.
A pork reach, I think, is obviously the phrase of the podcast at this point. I want to go to Heather in a moment, but Michael, so give us kind of an update. How quickly is all of this going to develop, right? I mean, if folks are creating a timeline, what's the timeline for us to get through this, right? It's obviously not going to be done by Friday.
Well,
so benefits are going to, you know what I mean? I mean, there are 12 plates that are in the air simultaneously here.
Yes. And I mean, really, I'm not optimistic about something happening anytime soon. The next really there's two deadlines hanging over our heads. One is at the end of the day tomorrow, the expiration of eviction protection and, you know, the extended unemployment benefits. But next really is the Democratic Convention that starts the week of August 17th. Now, normally, members are out of town for the month of August, but in the COVID era, there's nowhere to go. So there's no sense of urgency in a sense because they have travel abroad or other places to go to. So Congress will be now on call for those first 2 weeks of August to come back and vote on a final package. The plan would be to pass appropriations sometime late tomorrow, and everybody heads home. And once there's a deal, they're on 24 hours notice to fly back. But from what we see, I don't see a deal coming together anytime soon. Now, it is possible tomorrow that they do a short-term extension of these benefits. So it's a game of chicken and one side of blinks. But absent that, I don't see a deal coming together until just before the Democratic Convention, if at all. And I think if a deal does come together, it looks to me like it's going to have to be passed with mostly Democratic votes in order to get it passed.
Wow. Let's go to Germany. An announcement that everybody, I think, expected in the wake of the news reports. Wall Street Journal, I think, was first in reporting that the administration was considering it. That story came out a couple of days after the president had a conversation with Vladimir Putin, as sadly a lot of the news flow tends to follow some of those conversations, especially if they involve Russia. Heather, walk us through. 12,000 troops are going to be cut from Germany. About half of those would come back to the United States. The other half would get redistributed or relocated across Europe, some to Italy. 2,000 would go to Belgium because the U.S. European Command headquarters that are now in Germany would move closer to SHAPE headquarters, the Supreme Headquarters Allies Powered Europe in Mons, both originally in Paris and Versailles, respectively. Walk us through the impact of this decision. And I want to get everybody's take on it, on the, you know, whether or not it would do what Dr. Esper said, which is improve NATO, make allies strong, you know, strengthen NATO, strengthen allies, and better deter Russia. And there's a perception that actually it would do none of those three. Why don't you start us off?
Yeah, absolutely. So you're exactly right. You know, about a month ago, the rumor was that about 9,500 U.S. forces would be leaving Germany. Yesterday's announcement was they discovered more U.S. forces in Germany than they had originally counted, and almost 12,000, 11,900 U.S. forces based in Germany will be leaving. 6,400 will be coming back to the United States. And 5,600 will be redistributed across Europe, as you said, Belgium and Italy. In some ways, this is basically taking Stuttgart and breaking it apart a bit. AFRICOM headquarters is in Stuttgart, obviously, and moving a lot of those UCOM forces up to Mons. Secretary Esper went through a torturous explanation, a five-point explanation of why this was happening, citing that this was part of a global force posture and their highest order of magnitude was implementing the National Defense Strategy, which, of course, great power competition, how to deter China and Russia. And of course, all of us who know these strategies know that allies are central to great power competition. And then he went on to say that this was about reassuring our allies and deterring Russia and operational flexibility and ensuring our families. Of course, this very elaborate discussion was completely undercut when the president got out ahead of him as he was explaining this to members of Congress and to the public. And he said, no, it's because Germany is delinquent on its payments and I've ordered them to come back. So it was just it was so painful to watch this explanation that was absolutely not true. And it should be embarrassing to General Walters, to Secretary, who's SACUR, Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, Secretary Esper, they should be completely embarrassed. I think it would have been better to say, we received an order from our Commander in Chief, and this is how we have decided to do that. This is what we think is in the best interest. The only point I would, two points I'd argue. The one thing that Secretary Esper did mention, the operational flexibility, is that we need a little bit more force posture on the southeastern European flank and the Black Sea region, which has been absolutely true for quite some time, and that some forces may be moved to Romania to sort of buttress that, which I think is good news, and that's right. The other thing that General Hodges, a former USIR commander, said, I think it was yesterday, this is not that U.S. forces don't defend Germany in the sense of the Cold War and the Fulda Gap. Germany is a platform that U.S. forces use to get rapidly to the Middle East, to Africa. It is a platform, and we have just harmed our ability to be able to use that platform effectively. There was no consultation with the German government. There was no attempts to even get more funding for U.S. forces based in Germany. This was about getting back at Germany, and the president wanted this to happen, and by golly, it rolled out yesterday. And the only government that's been happy about this, the Russian government spokesman said that they were very pleased with this move.
Fago, can I weigh in real quickly?
Of course.
So while Chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Jim Inhofe, has expressed his support for this plan, this withdrawal from Germany, partial withdrawal, and forces coming home and forces moving elsewhere in Europe, Congress is not going to provide a single penny for this at all this year. It's completely, on the back burner. President Trump has given himself wiggle room to walk it back if he is reelected, or if something changes, well, whenever he feels like it, I suppose. And if there is a new administration in the fall, they will absolutely walk it back. Now, it'll be a little bit difficult if we've named allies, which they have. There's some considerations that would have to be made, and it doesn't mean it's going to be, not happen at all. But for the most part, this is a years-long effort, but nothing is going to happen anytime soon.
Let me quickly, and just so that everybody knows, we've got 7 minutes left in the program. We're trying to keep this to 35 minutes because the listen rate is much, much higher at 35 than it is anywhere else. So we'll keep it more focused on these two topics. 3, 2, 1. Michael, really quickly, give me a sense on where lawmakers are on this. I mean, is there a chance that lawmakers are just going to simply say, we're not going to authorize any money for this to happen at all?
I do, but I also think, that the train's kind of left the station. We saw that there was language in the bills on this already, but that really doesn't have a lot of teeth. So I think the ultimate decision on all this will be made by the next administration, whether it's a second Trump term or what I think is more likely a Biden term.
And of course, Team Biden has made it abundantly clear that they are more likely than not to reverse the decision. Let's talk very briefly about what happened with the candidate. And Heather, maybe if you can start us off on this as well. Retired United States Army Brigadier General Tata was supposed to have a hearing today in front of the Senate Armed Services Committee to become confirmed as the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, a position that's been open since John Rood left. What was that all about?
Well, this is a very important position, number three in the Pentagon, that really shapes overarching policy. And it looks as if members were not only incredibly uncomfortable with some of the information they were receiving about the candidate, but they didn't have enough information to go on. So this is, and just to pull on the last comment, even if the issues that Secretary Esper briefed, the troop withdrawals don't happen, the damage has been done to our relationship. That's not going to recover very quickly. And I think it just, this confirmation or lack of confirmation hearing just continues to underscore the vacancies at the Pentagon when we really need big decisions on big policy issues there moving forward without the personnel.
Anybody else want to weigh in on that in terms of
Could I just go back to the question in Germany that
of course, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I, you know, this is more the commercial angle to it, but Germany does have some interesting decisions that involve major U.S. platforms. There's an ongoing competition to replace the CH-53E heavy lift helicopters. That's both a Boeing and Lockheed Martin competition. And then further downstream, the Luftwaffe had basically, I think they designated that they were interested in selecting the F-18 to fulfill their nuclear mission as part of this replacement for their older Tornadoes. So I'd just be curious to see how this troop withdrawal decision, if it's followed through in its entirety, how that might affect the standing in those two competitions and whether Germany looks elsewhere for that kit.
Anybody else want to add any last thoughts before we part for the week?
Well, I think it's just worth mentioning that the people are prognosticating the future. If there were a Biden administration, a draft Democratic platform is now floating around. And what's interesting about the Democratic platform that's floating around is that it's not terribly interesting. That is to say, we may be entering a period of boredom and an attempt to return to some other status quo ante. On the budget in particular, it's worth saying that the platform draft does say the question, the measure of our security is not how much we spend on defense, but how we spend on defense and what proportion goes to other tools in the foreign policy kit. But basically, the only thing I think you can tease a couple of things out of it. One is probably relatively flat, if not declining budgets. Like we've said before on this program, not deep cuts, but flat budgets. Interestingly, in the platform, there's a specific singling out of the nuclear projections. Trump administration's new nuclear weapons are unnecessary, wasteful, and indefensible. No specifics here, but that's an interesting thrust. Secondly, that there's a real stepping back, reauthorize a much more constrained authorization for the use of military force and eliminate the two now in play, not confront Iran, China. It's not primarily a military problem. A sort of general stand down, constrain, caution with respect to handling both spending, weapons choices, and relationships with allies, though generally quite supportive of alliances and those kinds of relationships. So it's not an exciting forecast, but it may be good because it's a relatively predictable forecast.
Very briefly, we've got about 2 minutes left. Byron, if it's okay, I'm going to go with you, and then Michael to talk a little bit about Louis Gohmert. Mackenzie, if you want, you're welcome to chime in on this budget question. Byron, you've been studying this and writing about this. How big of an impact? I mean, the Biden platform does say we can spend a lot less money on defense and still tend to the security needs of the nation. Any estimate onto how much money that means at this point? Because there is some debate about how much further down the budget will go.
No, I mean, I still think there's a consensus in industry, at least, that, you know, it's going to be flat in current dollars. But I'm really not, we talked about this before. I mean, the idea that Biden would come in and make deep cuts to defense spending, particularly given some of the foreign policies that have been discussed, I just think that's improbable unless, of course, there's a major economic crisis or, you know, another set of contingencies. But I just you step back and it's not just the usual suspects. I'd be very curious if Heather had any thoughts about what's going on in Belarus right now. And the Middle East as well. I mean, there have been a number of rocket attacks again that have started up in Iraq. So it's just not an environment where I think you could prudently make deep defense spending cuts. It's really going to be more an argument about how we're going to spend the money. And once again, if we can find any efficiencies there.
Heather, do you want to chime in briefly?
Well, I think what we're seeing in Belarus and their upcoming presidential election, we saw over 35,000 people come out for an opposition candidate. And we just don't entirely know whether the president of Belarus, President Lukashenko, actually accidentally stumbled upon 33 or 32 Wagner representatives that were on their way to someplace else. They were cutting through Belarus because Belarus is still open per COVID. And Mr. Lukashenko decided to use their presence there to try to foment some challenge. We have no idea. But what we're seeing, whether it's in the Russian Far East or Belarus, we have a very restless Russia right now domestically and in its neighborhood. And that has to be a moment where we have to increase our vigilance and our indicators and warnings, because this is a very, very dynamic situation.
And obviously, protests in the Far East in particular, after Moscow arrested the governor in, where was the governor, Heather?
In Khabarovsk,
that's right. And accused him of, you know, an outstanding murder warrant from like 15 or 18 years ago. Michael, let's end with you. Louis Gohmert may have coronavirus. He may have affected other lawmakers. Of course, the sad news today, Herman Cain, former presidential candidate, sadly passed away. He had contracted the coronavirus around the time of President Trump's Tulsa rally. Talk to us a little bit about the impact this is all going to have on lawmakers very briefly.
Well, briefly, I think this continues to add to the chaos within the Republican Party, because it shows that some of the real diehards are willing to literally follow the president's lead on responding to the virus to their peril, both physically and politically. And, you know, by behaving this way, which it's really has proven to be endangering the recovery, which is going to cost us more money and require more relief packages, which also endangers defense spending in the future. So, you know, it's just emblematic of where the Republicans are. Not only did Louis Gohmert get infected, but, you know, his own staff has been revolting against him to the media anonymously, saying that he's forced them all to come to work, and it has been lambasting staffers who tried to come back to work safely by wearing face coverings. So it doesn't bode well, I think, for the Republicans politically at all.
Bago, there's one more thing that doesn't bode well for Republicans, which were President Obama's remarks today at the funeral of Congressman John Lewis, where he basically called for a variety of things, you know, to accomplish in a Biden administration, including, you know, making Election Day a holiday, restoring voting rights to those who've previously been incarcerated, automatic voter registration, et cetera. And he says, do all of this, even if it means you kill the filibuster. That is a powerful endorsement of the nuclear option from one of the most influential Democrats in the country, and gives a lot of momentum to that possibility actually happening more, I think, than any other time previously in, you know, recent times where we've heard of this in different administrations in the last 12 years or so. And that also is a significant threat to the top one. I think too many are too sanguine that, oh, Biden's just going to, you know, it's just sort of a flattish outlook. I think it's potentially much worse of an outlook for defense than that.
Everybody, thanks very much for joining us. Looking forward to picking up the conversation next week. Everybody, thank you. Heather, thank you for making time for us to be our special Germany discussant. Hope everybody has a great weekend, great week, and we'll have you back on next week. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Fargo.
Thank you.
Take care. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Fargo.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.